From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on October 19th, 2017, when NASA's Pan-STARR telescope spotted something unusual moving among the stars. Pan-STARR is a telescope that helps NASA track potential collision hazards, among other things. But this time, on that fall night in 2017, it wasn't a collision hazard that caught the attention of scientists. It was something else. But they weren't exactly sure what it was. Pan-STARR had detected an object moving at a speed that caught them by surprise. And just 5 days later, scientists had determined that whatever this thing was, it wasn't from our solar system. With more data coming in, we had enough for artist depictions. So what does this thing look like? Well, most think it's very long and narrow, about a half mile long. And here was another fascinating part of the mystery. Nothing else in our solar system looks like this. And while it seems to be rotating, it's strong enough not to fly apart. So what is it? Many scientists have speculated that it is a leftover archaeological remnant from the birth of another planetary system. Others wonder if this thing formed during the death of another star. But what about, well, it can't be a piece of alien technology, can it? The object is moving at almost 200,000 miles an hour. What powers it? As you know, it's aliens. I don't know, but this thing was given a name, and the name was a Hawaiian name in honor of the telescope that discovered it. It is known as Oumuamua, meaning scout or messenger from the distant past reaching out to us. And now there's at least some debate about whether it really might be an artificial alien light sail. Researchers at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics raised that possibility in a new paper. They wrote, quote, Oumuamua may be a fully operational probe sent intentionally to Earth vicinity by an alien civilization, end quote. And might that be good news? Turns out that climate change won't get us. The Oumuamuans will. So drive that Hummer after all, everyone. Seriously, this hour we want to talk about two ideas related to this strange object. What does the science tell us? And let's assume for a moment that it is aliens. What are the ethics of contact? We're going to try to have some fun with that this hour. Brian Koberline is a senior lecturer of physics at RIT and the author of One Universe at a Time. It's aliens, right?
Absolutely.
Yes! It's finally, for 5 years, I've waited for you to come on this program and confirm for me it's aliens. Show's over. It's aliens. Yeah, it's probably not aliens?
Probably not.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk about the science in a second with Brian. Evelyn Brister is a professor of philosophy at RIT. It's nice to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
So, Brian, look, I know it's probably not aliens, but I do want to work through the strangeness and uniqueness of this thing. Because everything I'm reading says we've never really sort of encountered something from another solar system like this. Is that correct?
That's absolutely true. Yeah. In fact, we designate things that we discover, and we designate them by type. And one of the things that happened was when we found out what this actually was, we had to come up with a new designation object for an interstellar object, something not from our solar system. So that's a pretty big deal.
Okay. And the artist depictions sort of range from, most of them look like sort of a long cigar shape. There's one that's more like a flatter pancake. What have you seen?
Right. The long cigar shape is the most common idea. The thing is that we have not seen the shape of this. What we get is we see where the light's coming off of it, so we know where it is very well. We know something about its makeup by the light that it gives off and how dark it is and what its color is. But the whole thing about shape or size even is dependent upon how bright it is. And all we have is what we call a light curve, how the brightness changes over time as it moves through our solar system. And so the brightness changes a lot. And so that means either it would be long and thin or it would be flat and wide.
What is this telescope that found it, by the way?
It is a sky survey telescope that scans the sky at kind of a fairly high speed, what they call a survey telescope. And the data that it got from was a mission that was scanning the sky looking for asteroids that could possibly cross Earth's orbit.
Okay. But a lot of people are sort of confused, I certainly am, about why we found Oumuamua after it had gotten closer to Earth. It got pretty decently close, something like 60,
yes.
60 times the distance of the moon, which isn't that much.
Right.
But why would we not see it until it was kind of past us?
Well, largely, this is not a very large object in terms of things. I mean, something on the order of a kilometer in terms of a solar system.
The aliens were smart. They didn't make this thing so big that we would catch it before it got to us.
Right.
Good job, aliens.
But it's not huge. And it's also very dark. There's something called albedo, which is about 0.1. So that means about 10% of the light that hits it is actually reflected back. So it's fairly dark. And the farther you are away from the sun, the dimmer it's going to be. So this thing was dim in the outer solar system, and it was moving very quickly. And so those are both two things that make it difficult to find. As it came closer to the solar system, it was brighter, so we could see it.
When you say moving very quickly, relative to what? How fast was this thing?
I don't know the exact speed.
I mean, they were saying close to 200,000 miles an hour. I just don't know how that tracks to, is it faster than other objects in the sky? Is it unusually fast?
It's unusually fast because the faster you're going, particularly for things that are kind of going to the outer solar system, the faster you're going, the farther out you can go. And so everything in our solar system is kind of limited in speed because nothing has enough energy to escape the sun. It's kind of the, you know, if you throw something up, it comes back down. But if you throw something up fast enough, it goes up and it doesn't come back down because it has so much speed. Well, this thing has so much speed.
Wait. Back up the science on that.
Yes.
Everything comes down if you throw it up.
No.
Huh?
No. What about space probes?
Oh, okay.
So you throw them up fast enough.
And really fast and really high.
Yeah. If you could throw a baseball, say, at 7 miles an hour or miles per second, it would go up and it wouldn't come back down.
Okay. I did not know that. It turns out, though, that I can't. The Red Wing speed gun is broken, but I'm at something like 58 miles an hour max. So, okay.
We're pretty slow.
All right. So take it from there then. Okay. So what are we now learning about Oumuamua? Is it so far away now that we're not going to, have we lost the chance to get any data from this thing?
Not necessarily, but the farther it's going, the harder it is to get data. So most of the data that we've gotten has really already been gathered. A lot of this is now analyzing the data that we have from Oumuamua when it was going through the inner solar system.
Okay, well, they could have given it a name like definitely not aliens. Like, what's Hawaiian for definitely not aliens? They didn't choose that.
I don't know, but a lot of these deep sky objects are found by the observatories in Hawaii, so you're going to have to start learning Hawaiian words.
I want to hit a few more points of the science, and then I want to talk about the questions that have come up on whether we should have tried to follow it and if we could make contact with something, what we could know about that. And then we're just going to grill Professor Brister about, you know, sort of the philosophical ethics of contact, because she's written dissertations on it. No, we're going to have some fun with that this hour. But on the science side here, Brian, this thing comes in, we don't notice it until it's past us, and then it's on its way out. It's gone? It's already out of what? Out of our system? It's not out of our system.
It's not out of the system yet, but it will go out of the system. It came in so fast that it has so much speed leaving our solar system that the sun can't hold on to it gravitationally. So it will be leaving our solar system. It is on its way out.
Reading from other professors and other scientists, they write that NASA has been expecting to see an interstellar comet pass through our solar system since the 1970s, but until now, we've never seen this. Why has that expectation been there?
So we know from the history of our own solar system that there have been periods in which there was kind of great turmoil. The most powerful one was the Great Bombardment period, where basically there was enough stuff and clutter in the solar system that it all starts kind of pushing on each other. Some of it kind of comes in and bombards planets like Earth, but some of it is flung out of our solar system. So in the formation of a solar system, you're going to get some material that gets thrown out, just gets thrown away from a solar system. And that has to go somewhere. And you would expect that as stars are forming, as planetary systems are forming, that some of that stuff might in fact cross paths with our sun.
What do you think this thing is?
I think it's an interstellar object.
Yeah, well, yes. But okay, so an interstellar object formed by what?
That's the difficult thing to really figure out, because in terms of its composition and what its source is, we really don't know. I mean, we know that it came generally from the direction of Vega, which, if you remember, Contact was the star that communicated with humans. But Vega wasn't there when this thing came from that direction.
Is Vega's a real star?
Yes, star Vega.
I remember Contact only briefly. So, in Contact, they were getting signals, right?
They're getting signals from Vega. Vega is sending them signals.
But how far away is Vega? It's not Alpha.
No, it's like 8 light years.
Is that closer or farther than Alpha Centauri?
It's farther. Alpha Centauri is Proxima Centauri.
They didn't choose Alpha Centauri in that? Why would they choose Vega? Is it more realistic?
They chose Vega because it was a nice timing for what signals they wanted to receive.
Okay.
So.
Okay. So I didn't mean to interrupt you on Contact. Now I have got more homework to go back and watch. Contact. But so if it's, you know, a detritus of some sort of interstellar explosion from either the formation of a star or the death of a star?
It could be. I mean, the trajectory, when you really analyze the trajectory, it starts getting very fuzzy. We know it's an interstellar object. We know from its trajectory, this is absolutely not from our solar system. It simply can't be.
It can't be?
It cannot be.
Why do we know that for sure, though?
So there's two big things that tell us that. One is that its orbit, most of the stuff in our solar system is in kind of a common plane, where all of the planets are all kind of in the same plane. All the asteroids are in a very similar plane. Anything that's tilted is tilted maybe a little bit. This thing came in at a very high angle. So it came in far away from the plane of our solar system, which means it couldn't have been thrown there by something like Jupiter, would not have thrown it very high and then brought it back. The other thing is that it's moving so quickly, it is escaping our solar system. So it came into our solar system with a greater speed than could be produced in our solar system. So it is absolutely not from our solar system at all.
And its speed makes sense. I mean, if I were spying on your house, I wouldn't just sit in front of your house all day. I'd probably buzz by, take a quick look, and then leave.
Right.
If I were being, you know, if I was created.
That does get into the other side of it. I mean, if you ask me if I think it's an alien probe, it's not. I don't think it is.
No. That's not what I'm going to ask you. I'm going to ask you a different question.
Yes.
What percentage possibility do you give it for being an alien probe?
Less than 1%.
Less than 1%.
But that being said, I would add the other part of it. And that is, the reason I would say less than 1% is because I'm very cautious in making a claim about something. There are lots of things that this could be. One of them is a probe from another star system. What's interesting about the idea of a probe from another star system is that the idea of using a solar sail and going to another solar system and kind of looping very close to the central star to see if there's anything in kind of the habitable zone, which is exactly what this thing did. When it looped, its closest approach was closer than Mercury, and it swooped out, so it would have gotten a good view of the inner solar system. And we know that it accelerated out of the solar system faster than gravity would have expected. So something was pushing on it beyond gravity. The idea of using a solar cell to go to another star is exactly the type of idea that we would use. If we wanted to go to Vega or if we wanted to go to Proxima Centauri, one of the top ideas would be to use a solar cell.
Definitely.
Get it some speed.
Yep.
And then when it goes into the other solar system, use a solar cell to go on to the next one.
It sounds like you're talking yourself into this.
I'm not talking myself into it, but that is...
But that's why Harvard scientists can write this paper and not be laughed out of the room, maybe.
Right, because it's not an entirely unreasonable idea. And we have thought about this, of how do you traverse the light years that it takes to go to another star system. It really is going to take something like a solar cell. It can't be conventional rockets.
All right. So on the science of that, if you listeners are like me going, I don't exactly know what the professor is explaining, I'm going to ask you about that in a second. But let me actually read from what the Harvard researchers wrote in their paper. They wrote, quote, light sails with similar dimensions have been designed and constructed by our own civilization, including the Icarus, Icarus project, and the Starshot initiative. The light sail technology might be abundantly used for transportation of cargoes between planets or between stars, end quote. And in the paper, the researchers theorized that the object's high speed and its unusual trajectory could be the result of it being a sail that is no longer operational. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now let's do the less than 1%, but let's say for a moment that it is an alien probe. Would it be more likely to be operational or not operational to you? Who knows?
We don't have enough information. I think if you're going to grant it the 1% and say it's an alien probe, I'm going to say it's operational.
You're going to say it's operational?
Just because if they're going to come here, they might as well have it designed that way.
Damn right. Good. Good for you. Okay, so now we're going down the alien track. And when it comes to, you know, light sail or solar power, explain it, like the technology of how that would actually work, how this thing is moving at such a high speed.
So the proposed idea for this would be what we would call a light sail. It's not a solar panel, but really what it is just a very thin, large sheet of reflective material. You think of like Mylar sheeting. That's basically what you're talking about, in just in a more advanced way. And the reason it's useful is that when sunlight comes from the sun or any other star, it gives off a lot of light, and that light has a little bit of pressure, not much, but when it reflects off of a surface, it pushes that surface just a little bit. So if you have something that's fairly light and you have a very large light sail, all of that little push of pressure is enough to build up over time to give it some pretty serious speed.
Enough speed to reach the speeds it was at.
Yes, enough speeds to reach those speeds.
Okay. But here's the cold water from another scientist, not just Brian. Corin Baylor-Jones of the Max Planck Institute for Astronomy, who has researched Oumuamua, said that previous research already offers natural explanations, just as you said, Brian. Mm-hmm. He points to a study from last year where astronomers suggested Oumuamua is accelerated by non-gravitational forces, and he says that that is not at all unusual for asteroids or comets in our solar system, and it is often attributed to outgassing.
Yes.
Outgassing.
So outgassing, if you look at a comet, like what is the difference between a comet and an asteroid? An asteroid, when it comes close to the sun, or if it's fairly close to the sun, doesn't have a lot of material that comes off of it. Whereas comets, they produce a lot of this material, this outgassing. It's basically ice and other frozen stuff that, when hit by sunlight, vaporizes into a gas. And that's why comets have a long tail. So the counter to that...
Go ahead. Okay. I'm just waving at the booth there, but go ahead.
The counter to that is that when we've done observations of Oumuamua, we don't find a lot of material there. We don't find enough material to explain the outgassing. So it's probably not outgassing.
Oh, see, you're talking yourself back into it.
But what it could be is something else that's similar to it, called solar heating.
Which is?
Basically, this thing is an unusually shaped object. And when you have something in space that is hit by sunlight, one side is warmer than the other side. And again, it radiates off heat, but it radiates off more on the warm side than it does on the cold side. So that gives it a bit of a boost.
Before I grab Chris in Rochester's phone call, Evelyn, you and I are not as trained as he is in the sciences here, but it's aliens, right?
Oh, sure. I must be aliens.
It must
right?
be. Are you convinced by the evidence now?
Well... it could be aliens.
I like the idea here, but Brian, there is an actual scientifically valid question, which is this. If Oumuamua is what you are suggesting, you know, the detritus of some interstellar event, why haven't we seen other Oumuamuas?
Probably because we haven't had large sky surveys in the level that we've.
So in other words, there have been others. We just haven't seen them.
There almost certainly have been, okay. But we haven't had the technology to observe them yet.
That is a great point. Look at my brain was going, well, this is the first one. And you're going, no, we are getting better and better technology. And right. So the likelihood going forward is we will see more of these.
Right.
Okay. Fair enough. Chris in Rochester has a question for the professor. Go ahead, Chris.
Hi. I was wondering if you guys could talk about the Breakthrough Starshot program.
The Breakthrough Starshot program. Brian, you're nodding over there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any specific questions on it, Chris?
Well, I'm not trying to suggest that Oumuamua has anything to do with aliens. I'm sorry, Evan. But very possibly Breakthrough Starshot could create a human craft that would look and travel a lot like Oumuamua would. And I'm wondering if they could talk a little bit about that, using the light sail technology, only instead of a star, it's powered by a laser.
Okay, Chris, thank you. Brian?
Yeah, so the Breakthrough Starshot project is part of a larger project called the Breakthrough Project. It's funded by a Russian billionaire, and the idea is to design a ship that could actually travel to the nearest star system. They could send a probe to the nearest star system. And the idea is using a solar sail. The current designs that they have would use laser power to kind of get reflect off the solar sail to give it a big boost as it goes towards Proxima Centauri. And then when it reached Proxima Centauri, it could use the solar sail to brake or slow down so that it could actually study the solar system.
Is it going to work?
It certainly seems feasible. It's certainly not a scientific barrier. It's more of an engineering barrier.
Yeah, this is one of those things where I think it's valuable for us, for us non-science small brains like me, to keep in mind just how big even our own solar system is. It's huge. Mm-hmm. The nearest star system is, what, 4.4 light years away?
Yeah, about 4 light years away.
Okay. And so even if we are successful in building technology like this, are we going to see it come to fruition, or are future generations going to see it do the work?
Probably not us, but possibly within the next century.
Okay. So, but I guess what I mean is, if we launch something today, how long are we talking about it getting to where it needs to go?
Well, the Starshot mission was designed to be extremely tiny. So you're talking about the probe itself would be smaller than a coffee cup, and the sail would be about the size of this room, so maybe 100 feet across or so. Very tiny.
Is that so small that it would be really vulnerable in space?
Not necessarily, but it's small enough that it could be accelerated by a laser. So they want to use laser power to accelerate this so quickly that it could get to Proxima Centauri in 100 years.
So even if they launch it now, it would be future generations.
Right.
We're going to see it get
right
there. Okay, I wonder when the aliens launched Oumuamua. I mean, it depends on how far away it is, I guess, and how good the technology is. Maybe it actually slowed down when it came here, right?
It's possible.
I would say it's definite. I want to listen to the comments made by an astrobiologist by the name of Karen Meach, who did a TED Talk on Oumuamua. And this is going to turn us to the question of contact and sort of these philosophical and ethical questions that would have to come into play. Because let's just say that Oumuamua sent us an email and was like, yep, guys, it's us. You would hope that there would be a scientific team brought into the room, the Brian Koberlines of the world, the Ben Afflecks of the world, you know. And is that who was in? was it Armageddon? Was that Ben Affleck?
I think.
Bruce Willis
sure.
and
Bruce
Ben
Willis. Affleck. Got to do Bruce Willis.
So it'd be Ben Affleck, it would be Brian. And I would hope it would be ethicists. I would hope it would be philosophers. And I would hope there would be conversations about what our approach ought to be if we ever are in that position. And we're going to get to that in a second. But if you're wondering, well, why don't we just follow this thing? If we know that Oumuamua is going in a certain direction, let's go get it. I want to listen to what Karen Meach, the astrobiologist, said in her TED Talk about Oumuamua and these questions about what it might be and what we ought to do. Let's listen.
But we can't actually prove that it's not something artificial. The color, the strange shape, the tumbling motion could all have other explanations. Now, while we don't believe this is alien technology, why not do the obvious experiment and search for a radio signal? That's exactly what the Breakthrough Listen Project did, but so far Oumuamua has remained completely quiet. Now, could we send a spacecraft to Oumuamua and answer this question once and for all? Yes, we do actually have the technology, but it would be a long and expensive voyage, and we would get there so far from the sun that the final approach trajectory would be very difficult. So I think Oumuamua probably has many more things to teach us, and in fact, there might be more surprises in store as scientists such as myself continue to work with the data. More importantly, I think this visitor from afar has really brought home the point that our solar system isn't isolated. We're part of a much larger environment. And in fact, we may even be surrounded by interstellar visitors.
When she says interstellar visitor, she means objects like this. So a couple of things there, Brian. First of all, she said earlier in her lecture, she was overcome with excitement about this. And there's a lot that you see that I think, and that you write about on your website, One Universe at a Time, that when I read and I go, this is huge. And you're like, yeah. I mean, how does Oumuamua rank in terms of scientific excitement for you?
It's pretty high on the scientific
excitement. It is pretty
high? Yeah, because even though we expected that these things would exist, this is the first one where we've actually confirmed an interstellar object.
And do you find it interesting that you only get called to do this show when it's interstellar discoveries that might be aliens? The last one was Tabby Starr.
Yeah.
Tabitha Boyajian is a postdoc at Yale, and her team of citizen scientists discovered a star with very strange light signals and changes in the dimness, suggesting that something massive was occasionally swirling around or surrounding the star, which does line up with what a Dyson sphere or a Dyson swarm would look like, which would be an alien technology that takes the energy from its host star if it's going to travel. Turns out they don't think that's what that is either.
Right.
I don't think. I think that's the latest is also not aliens.
Yep.
Buzzkill. but at least for a while, there was some fun discussion about that possibility.
Yep.
Is it weird that we only call you when we think it might be aliens?
I'm starting to be typecast, I think.
Yeah, as the buzzkill. This is where I actually think I listen to other astrophysicists who say, here's why it's not weird. They say we are at least approaching the point in our technology and our understanding of just the math and likelihood of other civilizations existing, and our technology being able to observe the universe, that it's not weird to ask those questions. That it's, if it's, even if it's less than 1%, it's not zero. Right. And that doesn't make us sort of weird sort of geeks. It's just sort of, it's interesting. It's even more interesting than just fun. Do you agree with that?
Right. I think there is, you can always ask the questions. There's nothing wrong with asking really any question. The key to doing it as a science is to be cautious in answering that question and relying upon the data when you answer that question. What's really exciting about that question, we've talked about the idea throughout centuries of, are there aliens elsewhere? Are we the only conscious forms in the universe or something? We are very quickly approaching the possibility of answering that question.
Whoa. What?
Well,
we never going to know? If, by the way, if we're alone, we're never going to know because we're always going to wonder.
Except that if we are truly alone, we will continually find evidence that shows that we are alone. If you're in the middle of a desert, you can keep looking for people. And if you don't find people, you kind of come to the conclusion that you're the only one out here.
No, but it's a huge desert.
It is.
Even Evelyn's shaking her head. Back me up here.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, well, there wouldn't be evidence of
a negative.
The absence, right?
Right.
You would just keep looking. You might lower the probability of finding something. You might think there is still life out there, but it's farther away or less developed, and that there were fewer civilizations maybe that were capable of this sort of engineering. But you wouldn't ever, I think, give up hope. And why do we have that hope in the first place? Why are we so...
Why is it
so important to us that there might be other creatures out in the universe, and not just bacteria, which is probably more likely, or creatures that don't have consciousness, or creatures that don't have curiosity? We want all of those things. We're interested in life, consciousness, curiosity, and engineering.
This is so good. This is kicking off our second half hour, because in a minute we got to get our only break, and then we're going to dive right into what Professor Brister is saying there. Why do we care? What really powers our brains here to even caring about this? It's because the likelihood in our lifetimes we're going to make this discovery is very low, for lots of big reasons, mostly scale, time, size, distance. But what's the old saying, Brian? Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence.
Yep.
Isn't that right here? Or are you actually making the claim that we're getting much better at casting a broader net here?
Well, I think we're either closer to answering the question with a definitive positive that there are, in fact, alien life or alien civilization elsewhere in the universe, or we're going to have to completely shift the question. Because right now, everything is pointing towards planets being common, life very possibly being common. And if we keep not finding anything, that shifts the scale of what question we're asking.
You are starting to be typecast as a buzzkill. Do you think there is intelligent life?
I think there's certainly a very good probability that there either has been or is
intelligent life in
our universe.
Is an important word in that sentence, because the scale of time is so big.
Right.
And even if there are intelligent civilizations, they probably face the same sort of climatological hurdles that we do with energy feedback as they progress. And
right.
They probably don't exist very long. On timescales,
that's one of the things that they would look at, is if we only last for a very short period of time, we wouldn't likely encounter anything.
Okay, but do you think more likely than not that there has been or is?
For all of the answers that we have, for all the evidence that we have, all of it points to life being common.
Yes, there we go. Thank you for that. He finally throws me.
We still
me
have
something.
A lot of not evidence.
Don't do that. Professor, you finally throw me something. Brian Koberline is a senior lecturer of physics at RIT, author of One Universe at a Time. Evelyn Brister is a professor of philosophy at RIT. So let's dive into Professor Brister's question. Why do we care? And what would we do if we actually knew, if the evidence suddenly changed and all the buzzkills were proved wrong, and we've got something to work with here, whether it's Oumuamua,
which is probably not aliens, or something else, because there are some really interesting questions that would have to be answered in that eventuality. So let's get that break, and we'll come right back here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on the next Connections, the local Ukrainian community reacts to events in Ukraine. With hostilities on a razor's edge there, we discuss everything that's going on and the perspectives here of what's happening abroad. Then, in our second hour, a discussion about who funds early intervention services. Who funds it, who's in charge, and the future of those services in Western New York. Welcome back to Connections. It is a very short break. I will tell our listeners, if you want to weigh in, I just got an email from a listener named Dominic who says he's loving the show because I'm clearly having fun. I have fun every show, Dominic. It's just some shows are really heavy. You know, so I have fun because I'm learning, but some shows are a little lighter and a little more interesting and from a light or theoretical or I don't even know if that's the correct word, but that perspective. That's what we're doing this hour. Oumuamua is what we're talking about, and that's spelled, if you want to look it up, O-U-M-U-A-M-U-A. It's a Hawaiian word. It was an interstellar object that passed through our solar system in October of last year, so just over a year ago. It is the first object from another solar system that we have detected coming through ours. Yes?
Yes.
Okay. That's big. I mean, that's really big news because NASA and scientists have been thinking for the better part of 50 years that they would eventually see something like this, and then they finally did. It's an indication our technology is getting better, at the very least. But there at least are some questions about what this thing is, why it is shaped the way it is, why it's moving so fast, why it was in and out, why it took all these weird pictures of us and sent us emails asking for us, you know, tell us your secrets. It didn't do that. But Harvard scientists were saying last month, maybe it's an alien probe, and that at least should be entertained, even though it probably is not. So Professor Evelyn Brister of RIT was asking, you know, like philosophically, though, I mean, if we're in this desert and we're the only ones walking around and we keep wondering if we're going to see an oasis in the desert, I mean, why do we care? I mean, we have a big planet here that we're, you know, that we should probably be tending to anyway. We have to worry about climate change and our own future. Why do we look to the stars and care? What do you think?
I think it stimulates us to think both about, like, about who we are on our planet and then to place ourselves in a universe that's larger than we could ever explore and that operates on different timescales. It really challenges us to think about our own lives and the span of our lives in a timescale that extends far into the past, far into the future.
I mean, is it just, was it, oh, I think it was Aristotle who talked about how man wants to know, even though I think Aristotle was actually saying, as we discussed recently, man wants to be given credit for already knowing, as opposed to man wants to know. But regardless, if we want to know, there's also a frustration that we may never get those answers. And do we have to sort of come to peace with never getting those answers, at least in our own lifetimes? Maybe our species will eventually, people like Brian in the future, but us not getting those answers.
Yeah, I don't think it's just about knowing, though. It's also about making things. And we want to be able to make things that can go investigate on the fringes of our solar system, can investigate beyond our solar system. When we think about the history of civilization, but also especially the history of science, it is often about changing how we locate, where we locate humanity in relationship to other humans and then into an expanding circle of a larger world and now outside of our own world. It challenges us to think, too, in terms of what we can accomplish on timescales that are longer than we usually think of in terms of how we build something. You know, I am raising kids, and so I think about maybe my kids going through school and in terms of 10-year plan or maybe a 20-year plan. I have a 20 years left in my career. And our engineering projects are getting larger. That requires thinking on longer timescales. But what you were talking about with let's send something into interstellar space, that requires thinking about something that could happen on the order of decades. And projecting ourselves into that sort of long-term future.
I think in terms of sort of weird ethical questions, my brain went in two different directions there because I think what Professor Brister is saying about timescales is actually really important because Brian, as we've discussed, we're not really good at thinking long-term in a way that is relevant to this planet. People talk about saving the planet with climate change. The planet does not need saving. The planet will be here. Right. It's a matter of whether we will be here. And when Evelyn brings up, well, we think about, well, what's long-term for you? 20 years. 20 years is not long-term for this planet. 20 years is the biggest blink, the tiniest blink, I should say. And maybe that does actually help us foster more of this mentality of what's sustainable. What is sustainable, not just in my lifetime or by the time my kids get to college or by the time I'm ready to retire, but actually sustainable for a species here. And that kind of thinking may foster better decision-making. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, it's interesting in astronomy, one of the things that we have is something called the decadal survey. Every 10 years, we plan out where astronomy is going to go.
Can you spell that, by the way? I'm totally going to look that up.
Decadal, D-E-C-A-D-A-L.
Okay, keep going.
But awesome. Every 10 years, we plan out what astronomy is going to do. And that works pretty well for the scale of projects that we typically work on, because they typically take about 10 years to build. Spacecraft take about a 10-year plan to build, maybe 15. But decadal surveys work good on the scale that we are now. If we're talking about interstellar projects, if we're talking about large-scale environmental projects, we don't just need a decadal survey. We need a every century, every millennial survey. And we need to start thinking about that.
But how do we train ourselves as people to do that, knowing that I'm going to be participating in something the results of which will be well beyond my own lifetime? I think human beings are really trained to think long-term is what you described, 20 years, your kids go to college, because that's what we experience. It's kind of a recalibrating of how we view time, isn't it?
Oh, I think that's right. I think it's an absolutely new challenge, and it's something that humans haven't really done. When I think about projects that have taken those longer time scales, and I think about like building cathedrals, maybe, mm-hmm. where it took 100 years and they had a plan knowing it would take 100 years. But when we look at science and engineering right now, it's becoming more and more common for teams to be made up of 10 or 20 people, 40. Now we sometimes see papers published in astronomy and physics that are teams of hundreds of people. That sort of collaboration and the kinds of structures that it takes to have a focused project that includes dividing up labor on such large teams has required really developing new organizational skills. And I think we could think about the same sort of thing for developing projects that project ourselves into the future. So thinking about how to organize projects so that we can get the kind of feedback and have the kind of follow-through that we would need to have a project go on for decades.
And I think that has to become more common as opposed to the rarity in our society if we want to be a sustainable society on this planet, which is really interesting. I don't know. I mean, there's these rare examples. We got to Pluto with, how long did that take?
I think 15 years.
15 years. I mean, again,
that's a long time.
But it's not actually.
The Pioneer probe is still going.
That's a great point, too.
And it was launched in 1973, I think.
Okay. In 2026, the Sagrada Familia is going to be finished in Barcelona, they think. Gaudi died because he got hit by a streetcar because he wasn't paying attention. I don't know if that never happened, if it would have been finished more quickly. But there's very few of these long-term projects that go on more than 100 years. Mm-hmm. And so when we think about building something to send away, it is going to be interesting to see if we have sort of the wherewithal to do that. Should we try? Should we be doing that?
I think in a lot of ways it's the only way we're going to survive. If we don't think on the scale of centuries or 1,000 years, our civilization will eventually end because the problems require a longer time scale than 10 years.
Okay. And then then the other side of where my brain went when Professor Brister is talking about these timescales is this. There's no doubt that we have to recalibrate our thinking for what long-term means if we want to be sustainable. When it comes to our decision-making, there's a debate about whether we should be spending the resources to create things that try to get to different star systems, as opposed to going, everything should be focused here on Earth. We have got a climate emergency. Our children and grandchildren are going to really be facing this. And everything should be focused here. I mean, can you walk and chew gum at the same time, or is there sort of an argument there that says it should be the here and now, right here? That's what.
Well, the reason that we think that some people would think that we don't have much to gain by projects that are purely for seeking out knowledge rather than improving the condition of humans living on Earth right now is that we adopt a decision-making process that makes us think that it's our benefits that we can see right now that affect individuals that is the reason that we take on projects. But that's not entirely true. And many of the benefits of civilization come from art, come from literature, where the immediate outcome may not be obvious, but we think that they are one of our great creations. Even when you take on projects in your own personal life, like having children, it's not clear that having a child makes a person happier. And yet you think it's a very meaningful thing to do. And so when we talk about taking on projects like exploring farther into interstellar space, then it's that sort of project. It affects who we are, what humanity is, what humanity tries to accomplish, even though we know that it may be high cost and may not have immediate rewards.
By the way, since population does matter for our planet, what is the research is sort of unclear on whether having children necessarily makes a person happier or more fulfilled.
Oh, it's pretty clear that it is not. It does not make you happier. It's about even, actually. Whether having a child makes you happier compared to people who don't have children, there are different ways that people live their lives, but the happiness factor is pretty much independent of whether you have children.
That's really interesting. It's a whole separate hour on the question of, can we stop with the practice of saying to couples, so when are you going to have children? For a lot of different reasons. But maybe that's just one more data point there. So then the question becomes, on something like Oumuamua, puzzling out what we can try to figure out about what we know about it, what we don't know. I heard earlier this hour, I think it was in the TED Talk clip, that Oumuamua has remained quiet. So
yes.
What does that mean?
Well, one of the things that Breakthrough Listen did, which is related to the Breakthrough Starshot project, was listen for any radio signals coming from Oumuamua to see if it was actually transmitting. Maybe it would come into our solar system and actually send a signal.
If
it were a piece of technology, it could be transmitting radio signals as a way to try and communicate. And they took some listens at it and didn't find anything. It's not emitting any radio waves or anything.
You don't think aliens who can actually get something here are smart enough to build something that would avoid our detection?
Well, if that was their intent. if they were just trying to look. I mean, that comes back to the, we don't want to interfere with the civilization. We just want to observe.
Exactly right. So this is why it's fun to talk to a professor of philosophy like Evelyn Brister, because, I mean, I've got like no interstellar scientific training, but I do like to kind of puzzle out whether we should even be trying. And Carl Sagan helped craft messages that we blasted, that recently got out of our own solar system? Is that correct?
We're on the edge of that.
What was that called?
The Pioneer.
The Pioneer.
So
it's on the edge of our own solar system now, and it's going out there, and it's trying to broadcast to the interstellar world.
Well, it's got a plate and recordings that if someone finds the probe, then they could decipher that and see.
And it's 70s music, so it's way better. It's got some music from there. So it's got a lot of stuff that's like really good. But then there were arguments, like serious arguments, that said we should never have done that. That the nature of any civilized society, but the nature of living beings is aggression, is to threaten others, is to dominate, and that we are putting a target on us. And you know, is that a really dark view of this question, Evelyn? I mean, do you really think that if we had any evidence that there was existence of others out there, that we ought to immediately fear?
I don't think we have any evidence one way or the other.
If we got that evidence, should we fear?
Why would we assume that it would be aggressive rather than not? Our own the record that they sent out into in the Pioneer, that wasn't, it wasn't intended to be aggressive, right? So
no, definitely peaceful and sort of a big old olive branch hurtling through space.
I think that all of these questions about the aliens tell us much more about ourselves than they do about what might be out there.
That's interesting. Why do you say that? I mean, our own fears, we sort of reflect our own fears on how we assume others would be.
Yeah, what we really think of ourselves, we must think of ourselves as curious but aggressive.
Or not trustworthy.
There you go.
Oh, see, this is why she's here. That's so good. That's so true. And Carl Sagan was much more sanguine about this, Brian. He really liked the idea, I think, of making this kind of contact. He did not have those fears. So what is wrong with us that we think anybody who could come visit us would wipe us out? Probably Hollywood doesn't help, but...
Hollywood doesn't help, but I mean, I think where people get kind of scared about making contact with an advanced civilization is that throughout history, we don't have a good track record of an advanced civilization interacting with a less advanced technologically civilization and having a less advanced civilization do well. We have largely been conquerors throughout history. And if there is an alien species that wants to conquer and they can traverse interstellar space, we're pretty much toast. Their technology is going to overwhelm us if that's what they want to do. I think Sagan's idea was that any civilization that can survive on cosmic scales has to have solved its own problems. It has to have taken a larger view and therefore would not see going after another civilization as reasonable or ethical.
Okay, now I'm actually much more on Sagan's side in reconsidering that evidence, because we don't, you're right, we as a planet, we don't have a good record. I mean, and we're sitting on soil right now that was Native American soil, and we can talk to our friends in various tribal communities, and they can tell us stories all day about this, but we don't have to look very far for that record. But that's interesting, that we want to become a society that doesn't just oppress based on technological advantage. Can we? Yeah, go ahead, Evelyn.
Well, what if we did hear a signal? What if Oumuamua had signaled us? How would we respond? I'm not sure if there a policy response? Does the UN have some sort of plan for who would respond and how?
Yeah, who gets to be the one who responds?
Gets to respond. There's been discussion about how to reveal it to the general public. But response is a difficult thing because, say, the United States could say, this message we've interpreted to be very aggressive, we are not going to respond. China could say, but we are going to respond, and they do. The international agreements would have to be held. We'd have to think as a single planet in order to make a decision. Otherwise, individual countries would make those decisions for us.
Who should make that decision, Evelyn?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, the good thing is that time is on our side, right? We're talking about long timescales, so it's not as though we have to respond in the next 8 minutes. Probably the thing to do would be to slow down any possible response to try to decide what's right.
I'm sure there would be no politicization of this, no political jockeying to be the voice or the crafter of the message. But I do think it's actually valuable. I mean, like, it sounds ridiculous in some regards with the problems we have on this planet. But there should probably be at least some kind of cohesive idea that if that ever happened, our first steps would be X. And it doesn't sound like we're...
Yeah. I mean, it gets into the whole thing of the Pioneer message. One of the criticisms that people have given Carl Sagan and those who did the Pioneer message is that it's very Eurocentric. It's very centered upon Western civilization. And yes, there are token representations from non-Western culture. It's still largely a European message to the universe and not a human message to the universe. And that's something that we haven't taken into account yet.
Well, let me read Gary's comments. He says, aliens will see us as we see other animals, as a source of food. That's from you. I don't know. You know, honestly, Gary, like, I want to give you an honest response to that. I don't know why you would think that. Because I think the point that Brian makes is if we literally have technologically advanced star-hopping and system-hopping species, are they really looking for the morsels they would find on this planet? I can't imagine that's the case.
Yeah, I think that most of the this kind of science fiction fear-mongering that, you know, it's made of people, that type of thing.
Did you just do a Soylent reference? Was that Soylent?
No, I'm sorry, To Serve Man, it's a cookbook.
Oh, I thought you were doing Soylent.
Yeah,
you know, Soylent.
I did accidentally. But yeah, we are probably biologically incompatible.
Soylent Green.
Soylent Green.
Okay, yeah.
With other organisms.
Yeah.
And things like water and oxygen that we depend upon are actually extraordinarily common throughout the universe. So you go to Europa, for example. There's more water on Europa, which is just a moon of Jupiter, than there is on all of Earth.
So
water is common. Oxygen's common. The type of resources that we would need, any alien civilization get it from anywhere.
Okay, well, to kind of close the loop on this, and Gary, the concern I would have is that we would be viewed as competition. And in that regard, saying we would be viewed as potentially, if allowed to continue progressing, that we would be probably viewed as either being stuck in things like FM radio and, you know, Kardashians, or we get over that and we actually progress enough to become technologically as advanced as this alien race and we become competition, and therefore we must be stopped before we can reach that point. I think there's at least some fear that that would be the case, and I think the Oumuamuas are there just to figure out, how smart are these folks? What are they arguing about down there? It turns out they're not be very concerned by what they find. Should we be worried that we're competition, Evelyn? Again, I think that's dark. I think that's a dark view of this. I'm left with a more optimistic view after this conversation.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that when we send the Pioneer mission out, when we send missions out, it would be to find out what there is, not wanting to feel lonely. And I would assume that that would be the same sort of motivation.
I hope so. So, Brian, wrap up the hour for us by telling us scientifically what might be next year. Are we going to probably be looking for more Oumuamuas, which, you know, in reality are probably interesting objects that formed after, you know, sort of the detritus of either a star collapse or some similar event? Are we going to see more of these?
That's the hope. And I think the kind of ideal goal would be we find one of these soon enough that we can actually send a probe to them in a reasonable way. That's the dream.
If we get another one of these next month, but we see it closer to us, do you think that we will mobilize a mission? Or is it more like in a decade we'll be ready to do this?
I think if we knew the timing, we'd be able to do it now. So I think it's good that we keep looking.
That would be very, very cool. So Oumuamua is the name of this thing if you want to look it up. It's really cool stuff. And I really want to thank our guests for being really patient with the host and indulging these ridiculous questions. But it's been fun. Evelyn Brister, I wish I was taking your philosophy classes at RIT. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And our thanks to Brian Koberlein, lecturer of physics at RIT, author of One Universe at a Time. We'll see you soon if you keep saying yes to these invitations.
Okay, yes, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Our thanks to John Andrus, not an alien, just an engineer. Megan Mack, probably not, just a producer, a great one. I'm Evan Dawson, who knows? Have a great afternoon. Talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.